We are talking today with Jerry and Sis Levin. Jerry and Sis Levin are currently based in the Middle East, working at various times in Palestine, Israel, Iraq, and Jordan, where they are involved in projects promoting nonviolence as a means for creating a more stable peacemaking environment. Jerry works as a full-time volunteer with CPT, Christian Peacemaker Teams, in its West Bank base in Hebron. And Sis, a CPT reservist, works as a volunteer at Bethlehem-based Holy Land Trust, teaching teachers how to teach peace. Jerry was CNN Middle East Bureau Chief Lebanon in 1984 when he was kidnapped by extremists and became the first of the so-called forgotten American hostages. And Sis is an internationally known peace educator and certified professional mediator who attracted international attention in the mid-80s in connection with her successful nonviolent reconciliation effort to create conditions by which Jerry was able to escape from his captors. Jerry and Sis, thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
If you'd begin, let's start with what originally got you interested and involved in the Middle East.
Well, we were swept over there. Jerry was made Middle East Bureau Chief, and I went along. I go where he goes. And in that regard, I was going from place to place, picking up credits as a postulant in the Episcopal Church. I was going to be an Episcopal priest. And so we were in Beirut, which was a very pivotal time, especially for somebody who knew nothing like me. Israel had invaded Lebanon and driven all the way to Beirut, killing civilians everywhere. The so-called Christian, quote-unquote, army of the Lebanese had massacred the Palestinians in the camps, again, killing women and children. Let's see now, that's the Jews and mostly Muslims and Christians. The battleship New Jersey sailed into the harbor and fired into Lebanon, killing everybody right and left. So essentially everybody was killing everybody else and everybody thought they were right. And in the middle of it all, Jerry was kidnapped and held hostage. And the roughest part of that was that the story was covered up. That's why they were called forgotten, as you said. President Reagan had said, hostages, Americans will never be held hostage again. And pretty soon they were, and a lot more of them, and held for a whole lot longer. So the problem goes on, and in my opinion, our understanding of the why of it is just almost non-existent. So the only thing brave I've ever done is I went public. And I said, what do you think these people are going to do, you know? And I went public and described the situation. And people came forward, mostly Quakers, but others, Christians, Muslims, and Jews. And read my book sometime. We were able to create the conditions to bring Jerry home. He was the only one in that group that didn't have to bear the position of having been traded for arms, as the others were. Maybe you remember Iran-Contra hostage scandal, a true scandal. And it was the same problem, yet Jerry was able to come out. And that changed my direction. I went back to school at Columbia. I did a master's and then a doctorate in how do you teach this method? Because it works. And I guess that's the dilemma of most people. Do we use the military way of solving problems, or does nonviolence work? Is there power in nonviolence? And I know that there is from my own experience, and I want our children to have a chance to know that too.
And Jerry, was that your first assignment overseas?
That was my first overseas assignment. What drew us to keep going back and not in a mainstream journalist capacity was some dramatic changes of mind about certain important issues in the world that took place in captivity. For the first time in my life, I wasn't a peripatetic journalist running around with nothing to do but think. I thought hard. And as a result, many of my philosophic conclusions changed. The most important of which was my views as to violence. Up till that time, I would think I was rather a typical human being, unfortunately, who felt at times violence has its uses, capital punishment, and so-called just war, which is a theory, so-called just war. In captivity, when I thought about my own individual situation, I realized that I was stuck in this situation not only because of the violence of the so-called bad guys, but the violence of the so-called good guys too. That many, many journalists, historians, social critics, and what have you at the time said we had no business being in Lebanon. And actually, personally, I felt that it was a terrible mistake that we were once again brandishing our arms and throwing our weight around in a way that was not going to help the situation but make it worse. As a result of this thinking, though, I arrived at what I called the context of my captivity. And that was what I have ever called ever since the futility of violence. Not just the violence of the so-called bad guys, but the violence of the so-called good guys, too. In other words, when I look at history now, I realize that no matter how you rationalize it, in the medium and the long run, violence simply doesn't and hasn't worked. The Durants, decades ago, once in their epical volumes of history, once estimated that there had been 29 years of true nonviolent peace in the world. Through all of recorded history, my only question to the Durants, if I could have asked them, was, all at one time? So that's the dilemma we face. And then quite quickly, that led to a spiritual conversion as well. I was an atheist or an agnostic when I went in. But the more I thought about the little I knew about Jesus' specific teachings about nonviolence, and especially his antithetical thoughts about the teachings of all the many of the religious leaders that came before him in his own faith, I really became an admirer of him, especially his teachings with respect to conduct. And the key teaching of all was love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. This was a revolutionary thought, an innovative thought, and I think personally a correct one. The tragedy of his utterance, of his innovative teaching, was that the world, whether they're Christian or not, but certainly too many Christians feel somehow vulnerable when it comes to trying to put into practice that specific teaching, and so they don't. So it's not really the fault of his teachings, that the teaching was necessarily wrong, but that for many reasons we all just can't quite bring ourselves to live it out. So as a result, my ambitions changed in captivity from being an upwardly mobile mainstream journalist, CNN bureau chief in the Middle East, to want to use my new understandings and whatever skills and talents I had, and I'm essentially a journeyman journalist, learned it on the job, in service to people who couldn't help themselves. And in time, that led me to Christian Peacemaker Team, being an activist, and coming back to the Middle East in Hebron, where we're located, where we are what we call trying to reduce violence, get in the way of the violence, get in the way of the violence of the Israeli army and the settlers against the Palestinians who can't help themselves, interventionists, but also communicators. We send back in a variety of forms and ways our observations, what is happening over there, the brutality of the occupation, the indifference of the army to the Palestinians, and in particular the indifference of our own government to this tremendous suffering.
You know, if you back up a second, Jerry was using the word teaching. I counted about six times.
Exactly.
Somebody observing his story, somebody very wise, I think, said Jerry had a journey inward and Sis had a journey outward. And that really is pretty much on the mark. I come from Birmingham, Alabama. I see you smiling. Do you offer me your sympathy? But when I was young, Martin Luther King came to teach the Young Blacks' nonviolence, which ultimately gave them or produced for them their civil and human rights in Alabama. He taught them nonviolence. And I observed that. I would come out of the Episcopal Cathedral Sunday School, where we as children were taught the Sermon on the Mount, love your enemies and do good to those who persecute you. And I would come out the front door, because our cathedral, like yours, is downtown, and I would see police, white police, with fire hoses and attack dogs going after these kids. And it didn't add up. The dots would not connect. And they don't anymore, as I hear onward Christian soldiers, go get them, kill them, kill them. You know, something's wrong here, very wrong. And when I was in Beirut with Jerry, still pursuing the theological education, because I wanted to be a priest, my teacher in Beirut, among other things, spoke Aramaic. He spoke Greek, Hebrew, Arabic, and is a great New Testament scholar. But he spoke and read Aramaic, the actual language of Jesus. So when you look at it in his actual words, in his actual language, there simply is no way that you can come to the conclusion that he meant for you to kill others for any reason. It just isn't there. You got to persuade yourself some other way, because if you're following Jesus, you can't follow him down a path he never took. It just isn't there. And I think we need to really look at that in churches, because we now have just millions of so-called Christian Zionists who are comfortable with the idea that it's all right for Israel to take over the entire Holy Land that was promised to them. Yeah, it's too bad they have to kill people, you know, but it's really all right. And they're very much persuaded by Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and the televangelists, and more than actually reading it themselves and having that inner journey where they struggle it out. And that's my challenge to them. I really would love to discuss it with anybody who comes forward with it's okay. This is what God wants us to do. And that's across the boards. That's Christians, Muslims, and Jews. I wrote my doctoral dissertation at Columbia on the role of forgiveness in conflict resolution. And I worked with rabbis, imams, and priests, Christian priests. It just isn't there in the basic scriptures. Somehow people have messed with our minds, and we're doing something that is very, very wrong.
Well, that's the theological challenge, and it's extremely important. There's no question about it. However, the political challenge is the challenge of the moment right now also. And it's a challenge because there are so many misconceptions here at home that are perpetrated, or myths, or lies, actually, about the situation with respect to Palestine and Israel, that are perpetrated deliberately by, I would say, malign adherents of the occupation, but which are unfortunately accepted as the truth by many people who, because we've talked and met them, who, once they do understand the fact, go about a profound change in terms of how they view the situation. Those myths, that propaganda and the lies, is really the core of the message that I'm taking about the country right now in the talks that I give. And I would say, fantastically enough, I mean, it boggles the mind, one of the great myths are there are many Americans, many, many well-meaning Americans, who actually think at this moment Israel's problem is that Arab hordes, a Palestinian army, is invading and trying to occupy Israel, when it's exactly the other way around. Israel has been carrying on a brutal occupation of the West Bank and Gaza still is under an occupation, although the army and the settlers are out because it's completely controlled and dominated by Israel. It's inside a fence and people can't come out. But this is absolutely true. They really think that Israel has been invaded and that the Palestinians have an army that's trying to take over their land when it's the other way. Many Americans don't realize that the map of Palestine has been shrinking for over 100 years from one that was a completely Arab land to one that now the West Bank, which in 1967 and Gaza occupied only 22% of what was all Palestinian Arab land at one time. Now, as a result of de facto annexation backed by the United States, only occupies about 9% of the original territory. Yet there are Americans who think that the Arabs are invading and occupying Israel when it's the other way around. Another, I think, important fact is that we have to try to dramatize that it's the opposite of what many Americans think. Right now, there is, on any given day, close to 10,000 Palestinian women, children also, and men and boys who are being held in administrative detention in Israeli prisons. That is, without charge. And they can be held without charge for 6 months. And when the 6 months is over, they can still have the detention renewed, although there are still no charges. They're out-and-out political prisoners, some who are just picked up off the street under suspicion. There's no due process. This should be another indication of an occupation and an unbalanced situation existing in that region, because despite what many Americans think, there are no Israelis in Palestinian prisons. There are none at all. Yet in 1967, there were no Jewish Israelis living in the West Bank or Gaza, or only relatively a handful, a very, very few. But in 40 years, the number has risen from 5 to about 500,000. And actually, it's doubled since the so-called Oslo PEACE peace process began in the mid-1990s. Of course, I call it a PIECE process, because that's what it's been. The Palestinian land mass has been shrinking ever since as the number of settlers being moved, I call them squatter settlers being moved into the West Bank, has risen geometrically. It's doubled from 250,000 since Oslo to 500,000. And as a result, the Israelis have been building a wall that is pulling them inside Israel, annexing them de facto to Israel. This is the kind of situation that's been going on and is not understood, and I think to a great extent because it's not being reported in the detail that it needs to be.
Well, and you worked for CNN, so do you see the corporate media as a major instrument in this?
Yeah, the large corporate media is a major instrument for a variety of reasons, one of which is the corporate media generally, the large media generally, and this is not just recently, this is historic, have generally, if you will, represented the views of the establishment, whatever that establishment is, by and large. And the larger the media, the more jingoistic in this country they tend to be, although at times there is corrective, such as finally turning against the Vietnam War when it was clear that their base was coming, even the media base was coming home in body bags in inordinately large numbers. And there's another reason, and that is that, you know, the old aphorism, journalistic aphorism, if it bleeds, it leads, holds sway here. It's much easier to cover the results of a suicide bombing. You're not going to be there when it happens. You can go there quickly. The Israelis help you to get there, to cover, to show all the carnage. The problem is that the press is not going to know where to go to cover the daily violent excesses of the settlers in the army and the Palestinian. How do they know when the next settler attack on Palestinian farmers trying to graze their sheep will take place? Where and when? How do they know when the next attack on an olive grove will take place in the middle of the night? The Israeli settlers will descend from a settlement and cut down all the olive trees. How does the press know when a private Israeli plane will fly over the fields in which the sheep are grazing and in which the winter wheat is growing and poison it? You know, they can't cover it. It's not as easy to cover. So there is that indifference. And so that side of the story doesn't get told. So that, to some extent, is inadvertent. It's hard to cover. And especially when the Israeli government, who accredits the international press, if they push too hard to cover the Palestinian side of the story, may get kicked out. CNN presidents have had to come a couple of times into Israel and beg forgiveness of the Interior Ministry in order to be able to cover the story, even as badly as they do. But the other aspect of the story is this, and this is deliberate. I challenge your audience. I don't mean that in an impertinent way, but here's a wonderful test that your audience can do. Tomorrow and the day after and the day after, whatever story they read or hear or see in the mass circulation press, magazines, your largest newspapers, radio, television, and what have you, count the number of times they hear or read in these stories about the Israel-Palestine issue, the number of times they hear or read the word occupation. Count the number of times they read that, and then compare it to the number of times they hear or see the word terror in a Palestinian context. I've done it, and it's in an inordinate disparity. And the fact of the matter is, when our press studiously avoids using the word occupation because that's the condition that exists in the West Bank, what they are doing is deliberately avoiding the elephant in the room with respect to this issue. The occupation is the elephant in the room. Unfortunately, the terror, extremist Palestinian terror, is an unfortunate reaction to it. But there is a very, very comprehensible reason, and that's that elephant in the room that nobody is willing to talk about.
I would like to add one thing I keep thinking you'll add, Jerry. My students, especially at the university level, are constantly asking, and they too see that we don't discuss the fact that Palestine is under military occupation, which a lot of people don't seem to know, and have been for 40 years. We never mention the fact that Israel has weapons of mass destruction. And here is this enormous coverage of running up on the invasion of Iraq, who didn't have them. And now all we can talk about is Iran and weapons of... We never discuss the fact that the totally supported Israel, billions of American dollars per year, totally occupying brutally, militarily, now for 40 years, another people, against all conventions, against the UN, against everything, has weapons of mass destruction and are quite angry enough to use them. So our attempts to settle this volatile, explosive situation, you know, are not discussed rationally and with good sense. Look at the why of it. What's going on? And instead, it's a very one-sided thing, avoiding or using silence about the brutal military occupation, the things that drive the occupied people to craziness like suicide bombing, which is minor compared to the gross number of them that are killed and houses destroyed. And then no discussion at all about weapons of mass destruction. Why is that, Mike? Can you tell me?
Well, there's a...
Do you discuss it?
There's another... Oh, I'm sorry. There's another discussion that's not going on, which makes it difficult to put what's happening to the Palestinians in an appropriate political and socialist social context. And that is the absolutely discriminatory character of the Israeli state as it is currently politically and socially constituted. Now, the reason I bring that up is because at this point, Israel, the United States, and the West have ganged up on Hamas, which won the elections, because they refuse to recognize, in quotes, Israel's right to exist. This is wordplay. What Hamas does not object and never has, and no Arabs have ever really objected to Jews coming and living in the Holy Land. They've been living there for centuries. As a matter of fact, at the time in 1878 when the first European Jews fleeing Christian persecution, not Muslim persecution, came to the Holy Land to establish a base, there were already 25,000 Jews living there. But Hamas, so there's never been an objection to Jews living there. What Hamas and every Palestinian objects to is the right of the Israeli state, the Israeli government, as it is presently, currently constituted politically and socially to exist, because it is a racist, discriminatory, ethnically discriminatory government. To be an Arab living in Israel means that your condition is a severe civil rights condition about the same as our own African Americans just before the civil rights movement began in the 1950s. Now, that's in Israel. The laws work against the civil rights of Arabs in Israel. In the West Bank and Gaza, however, which is under military rule and under military occupation, it's a much more severe problem. It is a human rights problem because it's ruled by the army, brutally ruled by the army, and so their condition is about the same as our African Americans when the United States Supreme Court in the 1890s ruled about the so-called separate but equal facilities, which led to all the Jim Crow laws and led to the elimination of all the rights, all the equal rights that of African Americans had there. This is another elephant in the room that's not talked about. And this is specifically what Hamas objects to. And I think their objections are well-founded.
We are talking today with Jerry and Sis Levin, who are currently based in the Middle East, working at various times in Palestine, Israel, Iraq, and Jordan, where they are involved in projects promoting nonviolence as a means for creating a more stable peacemaking environment through the Christian Peacemaker teams. To answer your earlier question, Sis, the answer is yes, but not nearly as much as we should.
Thank you. It's a little bit like 22 years ago. There was complete silence about the hostages, so much so they were called the forgotten hostages. And the thing that drove me to go public was the President of the United States looked right into the camera, and having said nothing for the longest time, he looked into the camera and said, "We don't know who they are. We don't know what they want." And then he made a sweeping generalization. It is just mindless, groundless, insane terrorism. Then they would take me down to the State Department and show me the video of Jerry holding up the newspaper with the date on it, explaining who they were, what they wanted, and what it was about. So, of course, my reaction was like the child that said, "The emperor has no clothes on." I felt compelled. I was the only one. There were a whole group of them, up to 12, held in one place by the same people for the same reason, announced to our government, who chose to cover it up. And so I thought that Jerry would want me to do what I did, which was pretty darn courageous, because everybody said, "You'll get him killed." And also they said, "You're unpatriotic. Leave it to your government. Stay in your room and read your Bible." But I thought it was important to say, this is what's going on. Everybody thinks they're right. There can't be one right in this situation, and certainly not ours, and certainly not lying through our teeth. CNN's motto at the time was, you have a right to know the score. And when I announced the score, they changed their motto. They were very angry at me for going public. But I think we need to do this. And one other thing, CBS had asked me to do the story. They were, you know, very curious about it all. And we worked for a couple of days with three cameras, Mike Wallace and me. They were going to give the whole 60 minutes to it. And I know it was good because one of the cameramen cried and said, lady, if I ever get kidnapped, will you come get me? You know. But the point is we went for the facts on the ground and described the situation. Guess what? I'm sure this won't surprise you. They never ran it. And I knew what anybody needs to know if they have the conviction that they should talk to the American people. And if they have the courage, go live. Don't tape. Sorry about this. I hope you'll run this one. But I went on the Today Show, and they would say, poor lady, it must be terrible. And I would look into the camera and say, you have to understand what's going on. Look at this situation, because I knew people didn't know. At least there was that breakthrough. And I'm quite convinced that's what brought Jerry home. And the others were held. The whole thing lasted a total of 8 years and were traded for arms to the Ayatollah. And the support went to the Contras, whom we had said as a people we did not want to support. So it was a scandal. Oliver North is a convicted felon, smiling all the way to the bank, a very famous and beloved man now. But I wish people would look at that moment in history, because it marched on heavy-handedly with many, many lives lost straight from Beirut to Baghdad. Totally predictable every step of the way. Even my youngest students smile at me when I try to discuss, you know, the culture, the history, the background, the situation. They smile and say, Dr. Levin, no offense now, no offense. It's the economy, stupid. This is about oil and the economy and manipulation, not only of people's minds, but of power in the world. And if we want to have a true democracy and a true voice, we're going to have to talk about these basic ends to a means. Identify, you know, of course, what the end is, but the means used, I wonder if it's worth it.
So do you see the biggest hurdle here as people's ignorance on the situation?
Well,
I'm a teacher. Yes.
Yeah, it's a two-pronged answer. The answer is yes, but it's also the deviousness of people in power who are encouraging the lack of understanding and lack of knowledge by perpetuating myths, myths, and slogans and what have you.
Lies.
And that is extremely, extremely serious. And it's continuing, you know, it's continuing apace, you know, after 9/11. Why do they hate us? Why do they hate us? And then within a day or so, President Bush talked about a new crusade against terrorism until his people shut him up. Well, what was that all about? I think that Arab anxiety with respect to the West is quite understandable when you consider that over 1,000 years ago, Europeans moved into the Holy Land, took it over for a couple of hundred years, slaughtered Christian, Jewish Arabs, Muslim Arabs, took over their land for a couple of hundred years, which was, there was a religious component, obviously, but with the big barons and stuff that led the crusade in, it was clearly an economic buccaneering attempt, and really the beginning of what you might call European colonialism and thrust for world domination, in which the inhabitants of the lands they conquered really became worker ants. So to begin with, one can understand Arab anxiety because that looms large in their history. But then, 1,000 years later, a new crusade began at the end of the 19th century, again from Europe. And that was the Zionist crusade, if you will, that began at the end of the 19th century. However, for perfectly comprehensible reasons, the Jews did need a safe place to go. You see, there's a myth that says Jews and Arabs have been fighting for 100 years. What do you expect? And then, and especially Muslim Arabs have been murderous oppressors of Jews, which is a complete fabrication and falsehood. There's rarely been any rarely in the history of Islam despotism with respect to the Jewish inhabitants of the Middle East. The real murderous, demonic oppressors of Jews were European Christians, atheists, and agnostics. So, especially European Christians. So there was every good reason for them to want to flee Europe at the end of the 19th century and find a safe place. The tragedy of militant acquisitive Zionism is that they adopted and adapted a paradigm of nation building that was in about 50 or 60 years about to go out of style. The European model of colonialist infestation and domination. That's basically what everybody who lived in Europe was brought up on. And that's a tragedy. If they'd come to live amongst these people and work out their destinies with them, because Lord knows the Arabs were living under an Ottoman yoke at the time, perhaps things might have been different. But why do they hate us? Well, at least one can understand when this second crusade began, a considerable amount of alarm went up in the Arab world. And the United States and the rest of Europe has done nothing to dispel that alarm.
You say it's gone out of style. I question that because my students, particularly my university students over there, constantly say to me, look, you'll never understand. We know you're trying, but you'll never understand because your people came from England mostly to the land and took it away from the people who were living there. And they make a comparison to what the European Jews did, came to Palestine and took it away. And then they say, and you got away with it. I wonder about that. Look at us now. I'm not so sure it has gone out of style. What are we doing? Maybe it isn't called by its true name, colonialism, but we have taken over another country, and we're talking about taking over another one, and insisting on how it should be run and what the government should be. I was there when the troops came in, and they were almost immediately set to the task of fixing, as Colin Powell said, fixing what they had broken. They pretty well wiped out the school system. And so they asked me, I am an educational systems analyst, because the whole key to education is in the system. And I looked at it with them. I felt really badly for those boys. A lot of them were openly weeping. You know, I just wanted to go to college. I didn't mean to get swept up into this. And they were given the task to fix the school system. They knew nothing, you know, about that. And the other thing was because they needed somebody, a professional, to help them, we were told that Halliburton was coming in for Kuwait to fix the school system. You know, they have no experience, credentials, ability for that. So it was a huge mess. And I would go and sit at the table in Saddam's palace with the conquerors, and the general who was given the field of education would say, well, we all have to understand what we're dealing with here. These people, let me tell you something, watch out whenever anybody in power says, these people, probably were about 10 years behind us in education. Isn't that right, Dr. Levin? And I'd have to say, no, sir, back to my days of saying your president is not telling the truth. No, no, Saddam Hussein certainly was a monster. No question, no argument. He had a nearly perfect school system. Women became doctors and lawyers. The School of Economics was probably the finest one in the world. And we bombed it, and we, you know, we tried to destroy it, and we told a lot of falsehoods about it. Now, we're going to fix that. It was an amazing experience, and I'm sure you know that. And I'm sure most people know that when we destroyed so much and so many innocent people and so many good things, we weren't prepared to make it right or to fix it. Surely there is another way.
And that other way is is one of the things that you two are pursuing in your work now. Is that correct?
Yeah, at least give it a chance. We study war and the history of wars and the solving of problems by military force, and that's all we understand. And there's quite a different story, and a story of power of nonviolence. Let's take a good hard look at Gandhi and Martin Luther King and those many, many stories that that went this way. What have we got to lose to look at it? And I think we are cheating our children by not looking at it systemically in schools, not a peace club or a after-school exercise in conflict resolution. It has got to be systemic so that they can grasp it as they grow cognitively. But it's a field, and a proven field, and a field that works miraculously. I saw Laura Bush on television the other day, and she said, yes, we have got to look at the fact that violence in American schools is out of control. And she admitted that. And that is a fact, and that may be our salvation, odd as that sounds. But her conclusion, not surprisingly, was, and she said, I'm an educator, not quite on the mark. She's a librarian, which is a very honorable thing. But to know how children learn and how it takes systemic understanding and presentation is really a very, very specific field. But anyway, her answer is, from a position of great influence and power, we're going to take all the retired military and put them in charge of our schools so we can get discipline back. Well, again, we're trying things that obviously are not working. Not working. This is not security. This is not turnaround. This is not a different approach, one that does not cost escalation and damage and death. The best thing that's happened to the Educators for Peace is the medical world has come on board. They're saying, we're sewing them up in the emergency room. And while we're sewing them up, they're saying, wait till you see what I do to the guy that did this to me. And then they're saying, if the teacher is trained, and few of them are, but if she's trained to recognize at-riskness, like the child went into a school and killed people and killed himself. And incidentally, my kids asked me, is that suicide bombing? And that's a question, isn't it? And then they asked me, does your government take bulldozers and bulldoze their houses? You see, it's a common problem, a dilemma that we don't talk about much. But anyway, the medical world is saying, if you can see it coming, which takes training, prevention is in the classroom. And when doctors say prevention of this disease is in the classroom systemically and comprehensively, then I hope people will listen. They don't listen much to teachers.
Well, prevention is also in the people who you elect. Years ago, I saw a movie, HUD, which you may remember. The Melvin Douglas character in it said something that I never forgot. I wrote it down. I have it in my wallet. It said, the look of a country changes because of the people we admire. And so that's why I say prevention also has to do with the people we elect. With respect to the one issue that's so important to us, Palestine and Israel, wouldn't it be fascinating, interesting, or from our point of view, wonderful, if in the general election, working backwards now, the Republican and Democratic candidates might be fighting it out on domestic issues, just beating each other's brains out on these important social issues, but were united in their feeling about the Palestinian issue, that there has to be a 180-degree policy change by the United States before anything good can happen. Because if there isn't a 180-degree change, it's only going to be continuation of bad happening. Well, how does that take place? In the primaries, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, seek out the candidates for their party's nomination who may reflect your particular social views, domestic social views, domestic political views, domestic economic views, but stand where you do if you stand for a fair, just, equitable solution to the Palestinian problem, which would be essentially a return more or less to the 67 border. That's the litmus test for your candidate in the primary. And that would be a way that no matter Republican or Democrats in the general election, at least we might elect a Congress or begin to start elect a Congress, which is to the right of the president, that might then become to the left of the president. And if that happened, you can bet the president would move back towards the center. And at perhaps one time in the future, say to the Israelis, it's over. We cannot continue to give you this inordinate amount of military and economic aid, which has allowed you to perpetuate the brutality of this occupation and continues to move settlers into the West Bank in contravention of all international agreements that were made after World War II, continue to move them in, and to continue to build a wall that is not a security wall but an annexation wall, because you intend to pull all those settlements that are on the now the Israeli side of the wall and make it part of Israel, not de facto but de jure. That ends. You must sit down and work out an equitable settlement. I believe it would become. I believe it would happen relatively quickly.
And you talk about those who are ignorant or maybe just innocent. I must speak for my Israeli colleagues and friends. If you really care about us, they say, you would help us stop this. Because it's an insane land grab, no matter what you are told, and it cannot build a secure Israel. It can't, and they know it. They say, please help us, help Americans to understand, A, we're losing our children, which they are. Their school system is an absolute wreck. The drug problem is out of sight. It's really massive depression and anxiety. It's no way to live. And the other thing is those who are people of faith, true Judaism faith, a beautiful faith, say, we're losing our soul. We can't go on behaving like this.
Well,
so
she's
if you really love us, you would help us do that.
She's brought to attention another significant myth. And that is the myth of Zionism, that all Jews in Israel and elsewhere in the world, especially the United States, support Israel, the Israeli government is presently constituted, and support the occupation in the direction that it's going, which is to pull as much of the West Bank inside Israel and keep it as possible. And that is simply not true. Some of the most important leaders of the opposition to the occupation, working daily, hourly with Palestinians and other internationals, are Israeli Jews and American Jews. The leader of Rabbi for Human Rights, Rabbi Eric Asherman, is in the West Bank every day fighting against the brutality of the occupation, the brutality of the army, and the brutality of the settlers. The founder of the International Solidarity Movement, that was the movement to which Rachel Corrie was born and was run over and killed by an Israeli soldier running a Caterpillar bulldozer that was about to demolish a house. The founder of the International Solidarity Movement, the co-founder, Netta Golan, another Jewish woman, woman, the leader of the Israeli Committee Against Home Demolition, another American Jew who's now an Israeli citizen, Jeff Halper. And here in the United States, many, many prominent Jews are absolutely against the brutality of the occupation and the taking of the land from the Palestinians, such as Rabbi Michael Lerner of the Tikkun movement, Norman Finkelstein, the great Jewish writer who is the debunker of all these myths that I've been telling you about, and many, 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 many others.
Like Jerry Levin, who are then attacked by the right and called, because they're Jewish and are pursuing this course, pleading for this course, proving this course, they're called self-hating Jews. Just as those who say America is taking the wrong and a self-destructive track militarily are called unpatriotic. We really must stop this crazy name-calling and look at true truth and true solutions and wonder of the world. Nonviolence works. It has power, and it works.
We just came from Honolulu, where we gave a number of talks, and we were the guests of many pro-Palestinian, pro-Israeli organizations, pro-Israeli organizations, one of which was the Jewish Voices for Peace. And we stayed with a Jewish friend who said something I think that was very powerful. He said, and he cares about what's happening to the Palestinians deeply, he said, well, maybe we're the chosen people, maybe we're not. He says, but I do know one thing. In the West Bank and Gaza, we shouldn't be the master race.
So how do people find out more about your work and your organization?
Well, my support group, who are trying to help me work with and trying to support the whole work in education for peace, kindergarten through university, systemically, comprehensively, and to break the barriers at the administrative level who won't put that into a school and instead put more guards on the campus and more machinery to test the children and actually are pushing it further in that direction. My group call themselves the Children of Abraham, and they have a web page, www.thechildrenofabraham.net. And I have an email for people to write me, and I will connect them with people who are supporting it, both in this country and over there, and actual educational sources of material. And you get me through drsis2@yahoo.com. The children call me Dr. Seuss, and I knew him, and he did an awful lot. His material is quite wonderful for reinforcing the nonviolent way.
As for me, I've just published a book called West Bank Diary, which is a series of reports that I've been sending back from Palestine and Baghdad. My wife and I were there as the war began in Baghdad, leading a Christian peacemaker team in, and we were there for the first 2 months, 2.5 months of the war. The reports are still quite current. Nothing is, the basic conclusions I reached, none of them have changed. If people want to know how to get that book, they can contact me at jlevin0320@yahoo.com. jlevin0320@yahoo.com. The name of the book is West Bank Diary. Now, West Bank Diary is based on a series of reports that I'm still sending out by email called From the Inside Looking Out. And if you want to get those reports at the same time you ask me for the book or don't ask me for the book but want the reports, just send me an email and ask me to put you on the list as well. And also you can read reports and read more about what the Christian Peacemaker Team is doing in Baghdad, is doing in Colombia, is doing in Palestine and the West Bank at their website, www.cpt.org. cpt.org, www.cpt.org. And by the way, all my past reports are carried on the CPT website also as well. This is my card.
All right. Final thoughts you would like to leave with listeners?
Our children deserve better than they're getting. We have messed up their world. Let's give them a chance to straighten it out and to have true leadership. They're eager for this approach. They are receptive and eager and happier with this way of learning. Let's give them that chance and put it into their education, because it can be done, and where it is being done, it's a model to look at and learn from. Come to Bethlehem and see where, under the most enormous pressure and trauma, daily, hourly, we are growing more and more resilient and able to produce true democracy when we survive this terrible injustice. So it will be a light to the world, I really believe. Come and see it now.
My final thought is that if you care about and want to help those Jews trying to help the Palestinians, those other internationals wanting to help the Palestinians, international Jews, Jews from Israel who want to help the Palestinians and help the Palestinians, what is important to understand right now, the situation for all of them is worse. Today is worse than yesterday for Palestinian freedom and independence, and therefore for Jewish security, for the security of the Jews who think the occupation is okay, and also the security of the Jews who don't think the occupation is okay. And tomorrow will be worse than today, and the day after tomorrow will be worse than tomorrow. And the reason is, so long as the United States continues this 40-year-long political process of looking the other way, while Israel continues to gobble up what is left of the West Bank and put a stranglehold on Gaza, so long as that continues, there is no rational reason to expect that there can be any kind of peace in that part of the Middle East, because the resolution that the United States is allowing is absolutely the opposite of any condition that would create a more peaceful climate in that part of the world. So the road to peace in that part of the Middle East is through the White House. And as I said earlier, it's through the kind of candidates you nominate for Congress, the Senate, and the House of Representatives in your primaries, and then elect in your general election. Everybody knows, everybody in Israel knows, that how the United States goes on this issue is how the Middle East and their part of the world is going to go. Either continue a bloodshed and unhappiness, or perhaps a new moment in which people have a chance to live together and prove that they can live together in harmony, so long as one is not trying to bludgeon the other.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both for spending time with us today.
Appreciate it.
We've just been talking with Jerry and Sis Levin, who are currently based in the Middle East, working at various times in Palestine, Israel, Iraq, and Jordan, where they are involved in projects promoting nonviolence as a means for creating a more stable peacemaking environment through the Christian Peacemaker Teams and the Children of Abraham.